Okay, Mishlei and Modern Psychology, Part 2. We're going to do another 7 or 8 psukim today. And very interesting stuff, especially for those of you who are parents in the room. Starting with the first source. Last week, if you remember, we spoke a lot about what the book is supposed to accomplish. Who's it for? You know, what are different people going to gain from it? If you weren't here last week, you can listen to it on our website. But tonight we get into the crux of the matter, which is the actual pieces of advice that Solomon has for us. So when we look at the first source, so you notice a couple very interesting things. So here's Pasuk Ches, Shema b'ni musar avicha v'al titosh Torah simecha. Perhaps one of the most famous lines in all of Mishlei. Listen, my son, to the discipline of your father, and do not forsake the laws or the instruction of your mother. Now, what are the differences between the clauses? Without reading the next source and without thinking what I'm going to think, what do you guys think about these sources? What do you think about these words? What's the difference between the first clause and the second clause? I've only got one more, so we got to spread the love.
Musar is usually, well, it's a tradition. It's something that's handed down.
Okay, there's some transmittance to it. Okay.
Intimate connection there.
Okay.
And also, it tends to be strict.
Aha. Uh-huh. So this the might be included in the translation of discipline here, right?
Right.
So something
that's associated with your day.
Okay. What about the chronology of the lessons? Right? Shema b'ni sounds like in what tense? In what chronological tense?
First tense.
Right now, right? Shema b'ni. You're getting messages right now. You should listen to them. And what is V'al titosh Torah simecha? Do not forsake the lessons of your mother. It sounds like you already have the lessons of your mother. Right? You have them. Don't forsake them. As opposed to the father, with Shema b'ni right now. Listen to it right now. Right? So it sounds like there's even a time difference. Right? Whatever Musar has to do with a father and whatever Torah has to do with a mother, they're coming at different times. It sounds like the mother already came, the lessons of the mother already came. Now it's the son, whoever the son's job not to forsake the mother, and it's the son's job to right now listen to the father. It's a very interesting concept. Sorry, you're going to have to share... Sylvan.
This is in the Geras Rambam also,
I think. It says Shema B'ni.
Yeah.
Shema B'ni is probably the Ramban took it from Shlomo, not the other way around. But Shema B'ni, and Shlomo says it a few times. And even though obviously he's not specifically talking to his son, he's talking to anyone who will listen. We have actually instances the Torah says, V'shinan tam levanecha, and the Gemara interprets that to be a reference to students, not a reference to children. Because we already have it in other places where it says teach your child. You don't need to say it again. But first of all, what I wanted to point out is something I said over Shabbos in the early minyan, the 8 o'clock, the 8:15 minyan, and it's Ma Tovu Alecha Yaakov Mishkan Osech Yisrael that included within one of the brachas of Bilam. How good are your tents and how good are your sanctuaries? It's the importance of having education in both places. It's not good enough just to rely on the shul, to rely on the school. Every person, every parent has to also teach in their homes. Right? Matavu ohalecha, the difference between a tent, an ohel, and a mishkan, and a sanctuary, is the private versus the public. So we also have to make sure that the parents are willing to do some education too. But that's at the core of this pasuk. Right? When we're telling our son that you have to listen to your father and your mother, it's because your father and your mother are teaching you. If they weren't teaching, so then you have nothing to listen to. Right? So Shema b'ni musar avicha. So what does it mean, these two aspects? So first of all, we already mentioned the chronology of it. But secondly, it sounds as if, and if we would sort of expand upon the chronology of it for a moment, so it sounds as if there's something which is a decision, right? Shema b'ni musar avicha means listen to it instead of not listening to it, right? It's coming at you. The musar is coming. Now you have a choice. Do I listen? Do I not listen? And then it says, V'al titosh Torah simecha, means you already made the decision about your mother's teaching. You already have that one. Right? If it's going to say, don't forsake your mother's teaching, that means you already have it. Right? If it means don't forsake, means you already took it. Right? If it didn't mean you already took it, so then what are you forsaking if you don't have it yet? Right?
That's logical because you're first raised by your mom.
Okay, so we're going to get there in a second. So v'yalti tosh terasimech, I mean you already have it. There's something you already have, and it's with you. It's already with you, and now your job is to maintain it, as opposed to what your father is telling you, which is something new that you're supposed to listen to. So, a couple things. First of all, you see in source number 3, the differences in modern psychology that some people say between mothers and fathers. So this is interesting. A lot of debate on this, a lot of different sources you could have brought that would go one way or another, but at least this one corroborates with Shlomo HaMelech. Specifically, researchers have struggled to understand how paternal and maternal disciplines differ, though a sparse but growing body of research suggests that they do, and in an unpredictable way. The limited current data set seems to indicate young children are more immediately influenced by their mothers, but that as they grow older, their father's disciplinary practices are correlated with their social and sexual behavior. But just because that may have been true in the past doesn't mean it always will be. So data shows that it's true in that a child is sort of geared towards what their mother told them when they're younger, but as a child gets older, so they get more geared towards the father's teachings, which is really what Shlomo Melech is basically saying here. V'alti tosh terasimecha, you had something from your mother, you have to hold on to it, right? You had it all along in your childhood. Now you're getting older, listen to your father, which is what it's saying here, listen to what your father is telling you, but also don't forget what your mother told you, right? As opposed to what this research is showing, which is that the influence of the mother somehow runs out as one gets older. Yeah.
One other thing I heard recently was a child knows his mother, obviously, from the physical contact and whatever.
Good.
How does he know who his father is?
Well, that's not the question here. But
I'm asking
you, how would you know?
And that's because you're saying,
don't forget
the father's, your mother's thing. But
don't leave your, don't leave
three different fathers?
If we're trying to do a DNA test, that's a different question. Here we're talking about if you know your father, so don't forsake what you're, listen to your father. We're not asking if you know your father. Yeah, you listen to other people too.
Okay, this seems to be specifically directed towards a little boy.
Okay.
Because otherwise it would have said.
Yeah, so this is an interesting question. It says the word bini. That's why you say that?
So we know that boys have to go through a separation phase that girls don't have to.
What do you mean?
It's called the Oedipal complex.
Oedipus complex?
The male children have to separate from their mother.
But that's from boyish sources.
Okay, I mean, it's an interesting thought exercise. It's not necessarily what Shlomo Melech is talking about, but in both Shlomo Melech is here saying, I haven't heard that it's only for a boy. I've heard it applied to a boy. I've never said that it's exclusive to a boy. But here Shlomo Melech is saying, listen to your father and don't forsake your mother. I don't know if he's specifically saying this to a boy. I think he's just bini, a person, like my child.
I get this feeling over here, like your mother would tell you stuff when you were a little kid.
Yeah.
On a different level. And as you get older, when you become more mature.
Okay.
You learn from your fathers maybe a little bit more.
Okay, that could be. Now, obviously, this is all traditional, and nowadays the things have become much different in terms of the engaged role that fathers are taking. Thankfully, that fathers aren't being as negligent as they once were. But nonetheless, this is referring to the traditional roles. But also, I think to what we were saying before, the natural nurturing of a mother, which is a physical nurturing, naturally leads into a character nurturing, which is just part of the natural way of life because of the upbringing of a child.
I was going to ask you about bini. It says bini and not bt, and the English says my son.
Yeah.
But you look at number 3.
We haven't done number 3 yet.
Well, just the grammar part of it.
I'm about to get to the grammar part of it. I'm going to teach number 3, and then you can talk afterwards, okay?
Says, by the way, it says, here my child, doesn't say my son.
Yeah,
there are different
translations.
No. Please, let me just say it, despite your warning.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say.
No, it's not what I'm going to say.
Okay, go ahead.
It's obviously, at means the females, Shene'emar, that he got a Torah. He got a Torah. He was the male. Should tell that he got a Torah.
Okay, that's not, and obviously you know that in biblical Hebrew it could be referenced to both, especially when it's a general phrase.
But is it proof for the mother to
That's because there's a narrator in the Haggadah. The Torah is different.
Okay, so
right? So what you find in this situation, and Henry was saying this before, that when it comes to the earlier stages, so oftentimes maybe the mother is more involved in the upbringing. But I would say that it's not only the fact that it's you know, just practically the mother was there earlier, but also the fact that a child, when they learn things when they're younger, retains that material, whether it's ingrained in a characteristic way or it's ingrained in a mental way, it stays with them for much longer. There's a concept in the Gemara that says, a concept called Girsa Diyankasa. Anyone's ever heard of that concept? But the Gemara in Shabbos tells us, Amru Rabbanu Kameda Abayim Shmeda Rabbi Yirmiyah V'lo Kibla. They said something from Rabbi Yirmiyah, and Abaye didn't agree with it. Chiasa Ravin Amru Rabbanu Kameda Abaye. Then they said it Mishmeda Rabbi Yochanan V'Kibla. They accepted it from Rabbi Yochanan. He accepted it from Yochanan. Better proofs. Amar Izaka Gemir Se Lishmai Se Meikara. If I would have been a better student, I would have learned it when I was younger. V'Hagemara. What do you mean? What does it matter when you learned it? You learned it now. He says, no, nafkamina legirsa diyankasa. If I would have learned it when I was younger, I would have remembered it. That's what he says. I wish I would have learned it when I was younger, when I was in cheder. Because if I learned it when I was in cheder, I would still remember it. I don't know if anyone has this phenomenon, but for whatever reason, birthdays that I learned when I was, you know, older than 18 years old, I always have to write them down or somehow record them. But birthdays that I learned up until I was 18 years old, for some reason I can remember all of my friends' birthdays from elementary school. I know their birthdays. Because when you're a kid, those things are, I guess, you know, taking up more real estate in your brain because you don't have that much else in there. So you just remember. I don't know how it works. But Girsa Diyankasa, the earlier things that you learn when you're a sponge and you're just retaining information, those things, for whatever reason, have a more established spot in your memory.
All the ruach that the kids get for Shabbos, for religion or whatever, yeah, get it when they're younger.
Good.
Because when you're older and
you're already established,
it's harder to learn right. Some of these things.
Right.
But so if
you grow up with it, you come up differently.
It's a challenge. It's a challenge in terms of memory.
The music of your youth, you can remember every
music
single
too.
Word of.
Good. Probably music too. Although music has, you know, memory functions that go beyond age, right? It's just the ability to remember things because of rhythms and stuff. Yeah.
When I was a teenager in Yeshiva,
yeah,
I asked my Rabbi Avram Abba Friedman over Shalom about this Atpsach. Okay.
Yeah.
So first of all, I asked him if the child is so young that he cannot ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
So he answered that right after. He says Atpsach. It's the mother
right.
is a directive to the mother
right.
to teach him, to raise him up, you know, right. to ask, to be inquisitive, etc. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe added, who was speaking to a crowd of Chabad, that this highlights the importance of the wife
mm-hmm. Right.
to lead her good. Husband to good mitos.
Husbands. Okay. Good. So we see this in Rashi. Rashi says, Girsa Diyankasa Miskayim Yoser Mishal Zikna. It stays longer when you learn it when you're a child than when you learn it when you're older. And then you see in source number 6, even Shlomo Melech later on says the same idea. Chanuch Lanar Al Pidarko Gam Ki Yaskin Lo Yasur Mimenu. You know, teach your child when they're young, and then when they get older, it won't leave them. Right? So this concept of teaching early on is very formidable in the literal sense. And many times you'll find in schools that all the rebbeim want to teach the high schoolers, right? Because that's when you can really teach them the real stuff. And you can dig deep. And you can really go complicated. But the truth is, if you're a teacher that really wants to influence children, you should take them before they're in the third grade. Because that's the most influential time for a child. And that's why I think also on the flip side, principals have to be even more careful about the rebbeim and the teachers that they hire for the younger grades. Because that's really where the influence happens. But moving on, let's look into the next pasuk. Hold on, Aleph Tes, source number 7. So why do you have to listen to your father's Musar and your mother's Torah? Ki levias chein heim l'roshecha, because they are leviat chein. What does that mean, leviat chein? Over here it says they are a graceful wreath upon your head. Va'anakim legargarotecha, and a necklace about your throat. Okay? It's obviously something symbolic here. There are interesting gemaras that talk about the jewelry, right? Right, that's what a wreath is. And then there are other gemaras that talk about the jewelry as sort of a reward for character traits. There's a gemara that talks about in Yerushalmi, people know the story about Rabbi Akiva's wife, Rachel, and Rabbi Akiva goes away to study for 12 years, right? And he comes back. And the women of the town are saying to Rachel, you know, you're crazy for letting your husband do this, blah, blah, blah. And then she says back, well, I would, you know, I appreciate what he's doing so much, I would give him another 12 years. And Rabbi Akiva hears that and says, okay, you got it. And he goes and he does 12 years, right? So when he comes back, she gets a special piece of jewelry, very expensive piece of jewelry. And then I think it's Rabbi Gamliel's wife says, hey, can I get that jewelry? And he says, no, you didn't allow me to do the same thing. If you would allow me to go and learn and you would have supported my, you know, my endeavors that way also, you would get jewelry. So there's something about jewelry and earning it, right? And the sort of the mitos and the character traits of earning jewelry, which is somewhat implicit in this pasuk, right? But the word leviat is an interesting word, because leviat we might be familiar with from another situation. What, Ron?
Accompanying,
right? Like a levaya, right? When you're escorting a guest or when you're escorting a coffin. So leviat chen. So what does it mean to be a melave chen? So first of all, you have source number 8, which I'll sort of say outside, but you can skip to the second line in the middle. Davar acher, ma'o ki levias chen, amar of Pinchas ben Bar Chama, l'chol makom shetelech ha-mitzvos melavos oscha. Every place that you go, there's going to be a mitzvah to escort you. What does that mean? Ki sivne ba'yis charesh v'asisa ma'ke l'gayacha. You want to build a house? Here's a mitzvah. Build a fence around the top. Im asisa l'cha delas. You want to make a door? You have mezuzah. If you want to put on new clothing, you have another escort. You're going to a barber. Certain places you can't cut. You have a field, so then you have the mitzvah of peya, or here it's lo sachrosh b'shor v'chamor yachtav v'im zaratosa, then you have lo sizra karmacha kilayim v'im katarta, then you're going to harvest it, lo six or sirch basada v'shachachta omer basada, so you have to, that's shichacha, and obviously peya would be included. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu afil lo hayisa osek b'davar, maybe you're not even doing anything, you're just walking. El mahalach v'derach ha-mitzvos melavos oscha minayin. You find a bird, you have to do another mitzvah. So says Rav Pinchas Bar Chama, the Torah is telling us what Shlomo HaMelech says, ki levias chen means that you're going to be escorted with mitzvahs no matter where you go. Right? The beautiful idea that the Torah is all-encompassing. It has something to say about every single thing. We've been learning some maybe not so PG halachos in the morning about how to go to the bathroom and to be modest. And you sort of, the overriding feeling you get is that there's something to be, there's meaning, a Jewish meaning to be infused into every aspect of life. Even, you know, how we go to the bathroom and how we conduct ourselves modestly. But that's part of what this pasuk is saying. But I personally think on a more psychological level is more intriguing the statement from Rabbeinu Yonah. If you look at source number 9 over the page, Rabbeinu Yonah says the following, Ki levias chein heim l'rashecha, Sim ra'ayasecha u'machshevosecha l'hisponein bahem. Right? Concentrate your mind to think about these things and to understand them. Ki heim levias chein l'sfunasecha v'da'atcha. That they are a gracefulness to your understanding and to your knowledge. V'agisa bahem, and you should think about them. What does that mean? That these things, that the Musar of your father and the Torah of your mother are graceful for your mind. So what does that mean? So I think this means a very important point, which is that something we touched on last week, but that our mental capacity, specifically the ability for us to comprehend certain ideas, is actually developed by comprehending ideas first. Meaning, as we grow older, our brains have a certain elasticity that allows it to develop much like a muscle gets to develop, right? Even though we oftentimes think that we're born with a certain intellect, we're born with a certain capacity to understand things, it can actually develop the more we work the muscle of our brain. So there's a fascinating example in the book Made to Stick that I quoted last week from Chip and Dan Heath. They say the following. A different approach was taken by a ninth grade algebra teacher named Dean Sherman. He said his students would constantly ask him, if anyone's a teacher, you always got this question, when are we going to need this? He said that at first he'd search for a real world rationale for everything he taught, right? Why do you need calculus and why do you need all these word problems, whatever. Then it dawned on him that he'd missed the point. Now he tells his students the following. Never, you will never use this. Then he points out that people don't lift weights so that they'll be prepared should one day somebody knock them over on the street and trap them under a barbell, right? You lift weights so that you can knock over a defensive lineman or carry groceries or lift your grandchildren without being sore the next day. You do math exercises so that you can, sorry, it has the little thing on the bottom here, improve your ability to think logically so that you can be a better lawyer, doctor, architect, prison warden, or parent. Math is mental weight training. It is a means to an end for most people, not an end in itself. Obviously, if you become a mathematician or a physicist or whatever, so you're going to literally use the math. But the point of what we do in school, which is always one of these pet peeves of every student, why do I have to know this? What is it going to help me with? So the answer to that isn't to try to figure out a way where it might be helpful, that maybe they're going to become a lawyer or maybe they're going to become a mathematician. No, the reason that you go through all the rigor of schooling is in order to train your brain in thinking, not necessarily for math, but for the ability to think about things on a deeper level. So when Rabbeinu Yonah says, Kilevias chen heim l'roshecha, that they are going to be a grace for your head, what he's saying is that it's going to help you if you concentrate and try to understand what your parents are instilling in you. It's not only going to be good because then you'll know what to do, but it'll also be good because you'll be able to have a greater capacity to understand other things. I think that's what he's saying here, although it's open for interpretation.
Isn't it similar to Talmud Torah Lishma v'lo Lishma? Learning Talmud Torah in order to do other mitzvahs, or just learning Talmud Torah just because you love to learn Torah?
Yeah, it's possible. Lo Lishma doesn't necessarily mean for other mitzvahs. It depends which one you're looking at. Sometimes Lo Lishma is a good thing, sometimes Lo Lishma is a bad thing. It depends on your perspective. But it could be connected, granted. Okay, but moving on, he uses these, and keep in mind, he's creating the construct of your father and your mother in order to teach you something. And in this case, Shlomo HaMelech is going to claim that it's in order to help you in the following example. Bini. He says the word bini again, which conjures up the same sort of parental construct. He says, bini, im yifatucha chata'im al tovei. If sinners entice you, do not yield, right? Don't give in to them. So first of all, this is the first time in the whole book, we've gone through 9 psukim. Everything that we've seen so far has been an internal process. Obviously, you're getting things from your parents, but it's in order to teach you how to be a better person, right? To build your character traits. Shlomo Melech is now veering into the concept of how to deal with externalities, right? How to deal with people that are outside of you that are trying to harm you. So the first thing he says is, if someone's going to entice you to do something, watch out. Be wary of it, and don't give in, don't be enticed. So first of all, why does Shlomo Melech start with this, right? If you're going to talk about a book which is trying to make us good into good, upstanding citizens, why doesn't he give another example of, you know, if a Rebbe comes along and tries to bring you to the base measure, she'll go with him, right? Why does he do the negative first, right? He says, if someone bad is coming, don't listen to him. But he doesn't start with, if someone's good is coming, so go with him. So why does he start with the negative first? What do you think? No ideas. So when it comes to this, he might have gotten it from his father. Who is Shlomo's father? Right? David HaMelech. David HaMelech starts off the book of Tehillim in the following way. Source number 12. Ashrei ha'ish asher lo halach ba'atzat rishayim. Praiseworthy is the man who does not go in the counsel of the evil people. Uvederech ha'taim lo amad. And in the way of the evil people or the sinners, he does not stand. Uve moshav leitzim lo yashav. And even in the presence or the settlement of jokers or lazy people, scoffers, he doesn't sit. He doesn't make them his company. So when Shlomo HaMelech is starting his own mishlei, he's taking a page out of his old man's book, right? That he says, just like my father started with, you know, refraining from the bad, so too I'm going to do that. But why exactly is he doing that? So we have a pasuk that we say every Shabbos morning in Pesukei Dezimra, which is Sor Meirav Ha'aseh Tov. Right? How do you go about life? So first of all, you have to get rid of the bad, and then you have to start doing the good. Now, oftentimes, this requires a certain, proclivity towards the bad, right? Hashem even says, right, that a person is bad from his beginnings, right? That we're all born with desires. When we're children, right, so we're very base creatures, and we go after the candy, and we eat without consideration, whatever. So the same thing, the same sort of inclination has to be undone when you get older. So when Shlomo Melech comes to the Bini, whoever he's talking about, presumably he's an adolescent that has the ability to read these words, so he says to him, you've been a child thus far, but now it's time to stay away from those desires. Now it's time to hold back and start deciding to do the good things, right? There's a story, I think I might have said this here, I don't remember anymore, but it's only been 3 weeks, so I should remember. So a guy goes to a tailor, right? He says, I want a new suit. And the tailor takes his measurements, and he says, okay, come back tomorrow, you can try on the suit. So he comes back, he takes the suit back to the dressing room, and the guy's struggling to put it on. And he's, you know, the arm's not fitting, the other arm's, the pants aren't fitting, and he's like wobbling out of the dressing room, and he says to the tailor, you must have got the wrong measurements. Or you gave me the wrong one. You gave me someone else's suit. This is all wrong. It doesn't fit at all. So Taylor looks at him and says, you fool. You have to take off your first suit before you put on the new one. So the same idea is true when it comes to Sor Meirav HaSeitov. Oftentimes we try to just be a good person. But the truth is we haven't yet committed ourselves to getting rid of the bad inclinations that we have. To getting rid of the desires that are still, you know, nagging at us. Right? So Shlomo HaMelech is saying, you've been a child. You've had all these desires and you've just been catering to them. Right? When you're a child, your mother just feeds you when you start crying. Right? She picks you up when you start crying. When you're tired, you just go to sleep, no matter what you're trying to do. But now you're an adolescent. Now it's time to grow up. Now it's not just time to give in to all your desires, but it's time to create a kind of equilibrium where you have the ability to refrain from your desires and to instead choose the better things. So first he starts off, just like David HaMelech says, which is refrain from the bad in order so that you can afterwards do the good, which obviously he'll get to later. But there's an interesting nuance that I want to bring up here, which I think is part of Shlomo HaMelech's guidance in terms of how to deal with the situation. Right? Because Shlomo HaMelech is now saying, you have to refrain from being enticed. So inside of his words, obviously Shlomo HaMelech has a certain wisdom into the words he's using. Inside of his words, he's going to use phrases that are implicitly there to help direct the way that you approach the situation. What do I mean by that? If you look closely at the words, so Bini, my son, im yifatucha chataim al tovei. How do you say sinners in Hebrew?
Wilferson.
No. Chotim. Chotim, not chataim. Right. So chataim are sinners, but they're not like, it's not like who they are. A chote is a sinner, but a chata is just someone who did a sin, right? So if you look at the Gemara in Brachos, in source number 13, you have a fascinating statement from none other than Rabbi Meir's wife. Who was Rabbi Meir's wife? Bruria, one of the most famous women in the Gemara. So what was going on? Hanahu bar yoni dehavi b'shavavusei de Rabbi Meir. Right? There are these hooligans in the town of Rabbi Meir, and they were giving him all these tsaros. Kamitzarulei tuva, a lot of tsaros. Have a kabai Rabbi Meir rachme alave alohi. I don't know how to say this word. Alavehu, right? Alavehu maybe. Rabbi Meir prayed that they should die. That's what he says. Kabau rachame alayhu, which means, at least according to Rashi, that he was, I think according to Rashi, I didn't look at Rashi, but I assume the way to understand it is that he was davening for them to die because of all the trouble they were doing. Kihech dilimusu. Oh, I guess it says in the Gemara. Kihech dilimusu, so that they would die. Amra le bruria divishu. But then Bruria says to her husband, to Rabbi Meir, my datcha, what are you thinking? Why do you think that's the way to approach it? Mishum dechsiv yitamu chataim, miksiv chotim, chataim ksiv. Right? Because we say this at the end of davening Shacharis and Rosh Chodesh. So say, yitamu chataim min haaretz. You should get rid of all of the sinners from the land. Says Bruria, it doesn't say, yitamu chotim min haaretz. It doesn't say, get rid of all the sinners. It says, get rid of all the people doing sins. Meaning, get rid of their sins, but don't get rid of the people. Right? And in a similar way, the Pasuk says here in Shlomo HaMelech says, Bini im yefatucha chataim al tovei. These people, they're going to be people that are going to entice you. They're going to come along and they're going to say, let's do the following bad thing. So how do you look at those people? You could say, well, there are people that do this. Or you can say that they are these people. Meaning, that are they identified by their actions, or are they identified by being a person who, for whatever reason, are doing bad things? So in my mind, part of what Shlomo HaMelech is teaching the child is when you approach these people, you shouldn't approach them as necessarily angry or reprimanding them. You should approach them in a certain sense of sadness, right? That they're people, that they're doing the wrong thing. They're not bad people necessarily. Whatever reason, they got involved in the bad group. They were, you know, in some ways, you know, had a bad upbringing. But when you approach them in a way which sort of dissociates them from their actions so that you too don't become enticed to become one of them, right? Because to recognize that you too are a person that could or could not do those actions, just like they are people that could or could not do those actions. Yeah.
All the Rebbeim.
All of them?
Chabad, okay,
yeah.
They would never scold their son, their children.
Okay.
They would say, "Siz pasnik." It's
beneath. Right, that's, oh, interesting. Yeah. Is that how you translate those words?
Pasnik. Not exactly, but the idea.
Not anything. Right. Yeah. Okay. Right, it's not befitting you. Right. It's not befitting you. Okay, good. Meaning you can be better, or you are better. Good. So what is the thing that they're trying to entice this child to do in this scenario of Shlomo HaMelech? That's source number 14. We're not trying to do any petty crimes here. We're going all the way. Im yomru lecha yitanu ne'erva ledam. Nitzpena lenaki chinam. If they say, come with us, let us set an ambush to shed blood, meaning murder somebody. Let us lie in wait for the innocent. And it says chinam, without cause. So it's interesting. These words are very interesting. We'll get to them in a second. Nivla'im kisha'ol chayim usmimim kiyor devor. Like sha'ol, like Gehenim, let us swallow them alive, whole, like those who go down into the pit. What does that remind you of?
Yosef.
Okay, so it could be Korach. That's interesting. I didn't think of that. But Yosef is probably a more relevant one because the brothers all ganged up around Yosef, right? And they threw him in a pit, right? So presumably Shlomo Melch is referencing back to that. But he says, he can do the kol hon yakar nimtza. When we get rid of this guy, so then we'll have riches, nimalei batenu shalal. We'll just fill our houses with all the good stuff. Goralcha tapil betochenu. And your lot will be part of our lot. All the spoils will be for all of us. We'll all just split it up and we'll all become rich. So a few interesting, right? There's the base level, the superficial understanding of this, which is don't be enticed by the people who are saying, come, you know, join our group and let's murder somebody and we'll become rich. But then there's also the nuances of the verse. Im yomru lecha itanu, walk with us. It doesn't just say, im yomru nerev al adam. It doesn't just say, come, let's kill somebody. Right? Shlomo HaMelech says, lecha itanu, walk with us. What does that mean, walk with us? What is the Shlomo HaMelech trying to intuit by the phrase, walk with us? Why is that something to watch out for? And this, I believe, is perhaps one of the most important lessons that we can learn in modern lifestyle, which is the danger of, for lack of a better word, mob mentality. And often, the reason I say it's modern lifestyle is because it's very prevalent on the internet. When you find a group of people that believe in a certain thing, it oftentimes drags you along with them just because you're looking for camaraderie or just because you're looking for somebody who accepts you, right? You accept an invitation from a group who might not be that bad because maybe you don't fit in socially with anybody else. And this is something that happens oftentimes online because there's very little risk but high reward psychologically. Right. They get sucked in because it feels like a social group. You feel like you're part of a club. You feel like you're part of something bigger. And oftentimes what motivates you is the bigness of the group or is the camaraderie of the group and less whatever the group is doing. So I think when Shlomo HaMelech says, L'cha itanu, Shlomo HaMelech is saying, the way that they're going to approach you is, come be part of our group. Come be part of our posse, right? Our little gang. Come be part of us. We'll give you camaraderie. We'll give you social structure, right? Something to hold on to and to consider your group. And that's how they're going to say, Nerev Al Adam. Once they say, come be part of us, they can say whatever they want. Because the motivating factor is that you have the social group. And then you take it from there. If you look, fascinating line here in source number 15, how social media and mob mentality are killing our ability to think critically. I don't know who A.Y. Grayson is, but he quotes a more established psychologist. We'll see in a second. Neurobiologists have found that when people break off into groups, their brain produces chemicals that diminish their normal thought pattern to a more primitive state. Fascinating. Which literally means people stop thinking when they're amalgamated into groups. Psychologically, it affects you that way. Dr. Hannah Arendt, you might be familiar, sort of a professor or an expert in totalitarianism, who coined the phrase the banality of evil, controversially argues that what happened in Nazi Germany could largely be blamed on ordinary people conforming to mass opinion without critical evaluation of the consequences of their actions. And I think if anyone spends any time online in these, you know, avenues, which probably shouldn't, you find this all too often, that there's sort of a mob that's created either through cyberbullying or through social media, that there's some kind of low-risk club orientation where everybody comes and just piles on and criticizes somebody. You get a certain feeling, yeah.
It's a rush.
Yeah, it's certain. There's a chemical in the brain, like he's saying here. And I think when Shlomo HaMelech says, L'cha itanu, that's what he's getting at. But there's another thing that he's getting at here, and which is part of the last part of the pasuk. Nerev Al Adam, nitz penal l'naki chinam. Let us bury someone who's innocent. L'naki chinam. So there's l'naki. Let's bury someone who's innocent, and then there's the chinam. So Rabbeinu Yonah points out a fascinating nuance by the phrase naki. He also says it by the word tamimim in the next pasuk. So he says the following. Hold on. Yeah, I must have pasted here, but he says the following. This is one of those things you have to teach the child early on. V'gam l'gadol, and even when they get older. L'man lo ya'aminu l'divrei harishaim hadovrim al tzadik atak u'misaprim b'gnuto. That one of the red flags of the people you shouldn't hang out with is if a person starts to criticize someone who's respected. Right? Starts to criticize a well-established teacher. Starts to criticize, you know, a pillar of a community. Starts to criticize a rabbi. Starts to criticize an accomplished doctor. Right? If someone is bad-mouthing someone who's supposed to be respected, it's an indication to that child or to that grown-up that that's not someone you should be associating yourself with. If they really are malicious towards someone who's assumed to be good, without evidence, I would assume, so then that's an indication to you that you have to be careful about associating with that person. And that's what Shlomo HaMelech is embedding within this phrase. Nerval Adam, nitz pedal l'naki chinam. Let's go destroy some innocent person, which Rabbeinu Yonah explains to mean someone righteous. A righteous person. You know this righteous person? Let's get him. We hate that guy. Because there's something about them that they have an antagonistic attitude towards righteousness and towards piety. So it says Rabbeinu Yonah, that's one indication. But then there's another word, and that's chinam. What does the word chinam here mean? Free. What is, okay, so the one way to understand is how this translation is understanding it, which is for absolutely nothing, just because we're doing it for nothing. But I think what it potentially means also is that chinam, that there are going to be no consequences. We'll kill him, and it'll be, we don't even have to pay anything for it. You know, well, we won't have to pay anything in terms of consequence, right? Nitz penalinaki, we're going to kill this innocent guy, it's going to be chinam. We're not going to have to pay any punishments for it. No one's going to find out. No one's going to be watching us, right? One of the other tricks of the evildoers, of the sinners, is to say, no one's going to know, right? No one's going to figure it out. And you'd be fine, because you're just going to get away with it, right? I mean, every parent in one way or another deals with this phenomenon where a child thinks they're going to get away with something and they don't get away with it. But the reason they did was because they thought they would get away with it. Right? That's one of the trappings of falling into these groups, is that they try to convince you nothing's going to happen. And obviously, you know, even on a bigger scale, you know, with you can think of different scandals that have happened, unfortunately, in the Jewish community. You know, people think that they get away with something until ultimately it's found out. Bernie Madoff, how many years did Bernie Madoff get along with his thing? Right? Decades, right? He made off with it, yeah. That must have been a newspaper headline or something, right? Probably a bunch of them said the same thing. But what's interesting about this, besides, you know, the applicability of it and, you know, how often we use this in our own minds, something else that we mentioned last week in our Parsha class was Bilam, when he's walking on the way, and the donkey, you know, tries to, you know, swerve off the road, and he starts hitting the donkey, right? Ultimately, he gets to the angel, and the angel, you know, he finally sees the angel, they start talking. What does Bilam say? Bilam says that if I would have known you were going to be there, I wouldn't have done that to the donkey. Right? So that's obviously not the right response. The right response is, I shouldn't have done that to the donkey, period. But no, I wouldn't have done it if I knew you were there. Right? He thought he was alone. He thought no one was watching. He thought it was just him and a donkey. So that's why he thought justified in hitting the donkey.
What about Moshe when he killed the Mitzri? He said nobody
would see me. Yeah, so that's a very interesting example. He didn't do that because he thought it was wrong. He did it because he didn't want to get in trouble. And he was right, because the next day he did get in trouble. But by the way, there are other mefarshim that talk about when he's looking around and he says no one's seeing him, it's kind of strange because he's in the middle of, you know, a slave camp. What does that mean, no one's seeing him? What it means is that no one sees what's going on. Right, and no one's doing anything about it. Right, Moshe's looking here and there, and the Egyptians just are letting this guy torture this Jew. And so he says, if no one else is going to do anything, I'm going to do something. That's potentially what it means, especially because the next day someone says, we saw what you did. Yeah, I thought Moshe looked around, and he saw there was no one there. It's a desert. It's not like there are trees to hide behind.
Wasn't he also looking ahead to make sure this person would...
You're right, so that's what Rashi says. That's what the Midrash says, yeah. But on a literal level, so that's what it potentially means. But then if you look... I don't have the next pasuk. Can someone read pasuk Tesvav for me? Ron, you have it?
Yeah.
Bini? Yeah.
Bini al pelet tiberach titam, v'na raglecha, min
tzivasam. Right. Don't walk on their way, don't walk on their path. What exactly the difference between a way and a path is also very interesting. But he ends off this episode, he ends off this whole paragraph with the word B'ni again, right? He already started it with B'ni. Now he's finishing it with B'ni. And this, I think, we're going to come full circle, because Shlomo Melch is trying to say, the way that you prevent this is by having strong relationships with your parents. Right? You have your parents, if your parents can inculcate within you the messages that they gave you when you were younger, so then when you're older, you'll have the fortitude to withstand these tests. Where do we learn this from? Another reference to Yosef HaTzadik. Yosef is in the palace. And who's seducing him? Right? The wife of Potiphar. How does he withstand such a challenge? The Midrash says that he sees his father Yaakov. Now remember, at this moment in time, he has no idea whether or not Yaakov is on his side or not. Right? He's sold down the river, and for all he knows, Yaakov was in on it. Right? Because Yaakov told him, go find the brothers. and then the brothers sell him down the river, right? So how does he know what Yaakov?
Yeah,
there are. That Rav Blachman is very big on this. I don't know if you know Rav Blachman in KBY. So he always gives this as a Musar Shmuz. And he always says, Yaakov, for all Yosef knows, meaning this is what Yosef's thinking about Yaakov, not what Yaakov actually did, Chas v'Shalom. But Yosef is thinking, for all he knows, Yaakov is working against him, and nonetheless, when he's in front of Eishes Potiphar, he remembers Yaakov, he remembers his father, and he remembers he doesn't want to disappoint his father, or he's ingrained within him those lessons that he learned when he was a child. And that's what's holding him back. That's the strength he uses in order to prevent from being seduced. And obviously one thing leads to another, as we know the story. But we're coming full circle because as I just said, Nitzpenan lenakichinam. It's no one's going to know about it, right? But the antidote to that of no one knowing about it is bini. Know that you're the child of someone who raised you. Remember your parents who taught you how to not do these things.
It's interesting. This whole thing relies on the notion of the virtuous parents. Not all parents are good.
Right? Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. And it's really a message to parents also. And it could be teachers, it could be anyone. But you should have role models. We got a better way to say it. That hold on to role models so that you can navigate these difficulties in life. So we see in many ways here that we've gone through the upbringing of a child, at least the most ideal upbringing of a child. Obviously exceptions happen, and every child has to be cared for by one person or another. But what we find from Shlomo HaMelech is that the upbringing of the child is what potentially is going to help them navigate later on in life. And through that, you know, you not only gain, as we said before from Rabbi Yonah, the mental capacity in order to comprehend and to navigate on your own terms, but also when it comes to certain things that you should have already learned from your childhood, you'll use those, you'll recall those messages, and they'll help you later on. So that's some of the next 8 psukim, next 7 psukim from Mishlei, which is supported by some of the things that we saw in modern psychology. Until next week, when we see a little bit more of Shlomo's advice. Thanks for coming.
One of the funniest scenes I've ever seen.